It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Hey, welcome to Money for Lunch. Good to have you here. I am still just a little bit under the weather. Not really too bad. But again, I want to warn everybody that, A, I will do my best not to cough, but instead to hit the cough button. So if all of a sudden there's a longer pause than normal or maybe an unusual silence, it's because I'm hacking quietly on the other, we'd call it. I've muted the show so I don't disturb you with my hacking. Yeah, that's what I meant. Anyway, but it's good to have you here. It's a beautiful sunny day in Phoenix, Arizona, as most days are. But during the winter months, this is the time that we all revel in because it's, 70 degrees outside or something delicious like that. It might be 65 degrees or something like that. Beautiful, sunny, not a cloud in the sky, so it's wonderful. And I'm not saying that to brag or anything. I know that in some parts of the country, you guys were under a cloud of wintry snow, and that's fine too. I just prefer, I've been there, done that, don't want to do it anymore. So if you enjoy the snow, well, God bless you. And if you don't enjoy the snow, then come visit out here in Phoenix or, Hawaii's nice this time of year as well. They also have a lot of sunshine. Interestingly enough, Phoenix and Hawaii are the only two states in the union who do not change times. So there is that connection there. I think also, because I've spent time in Hawaii, it seems like, to me anyway, that Phoenix and Hawaii also have the best sunsets. Now, if you think you have a better sunset than Hawaii or Phoenix, by all means, let me hear it. I'll be, send me some pictures. I'll post them on our website or, we'll discuss it, on the show. But anyway, not that it's a big deal. It's just, just the way it is. Now, I guess at that point I was bragging a little bit. I do think we have the best sunsets. Maybe Hawaii comes in, might be a nice second place. But, you got to travel so far. And, yeah, they have beautiful beaches. So that's a plus in their favor. All right, enough of me rambling. Let's get this party started. I want to just dive into this. We've had, interesting amount of news lately, and it happens quite often. We're hearing about cyber hacking or cyber attacks, people breaking into banking, into these banking institutions, these credit card institutions. There is a rumor that Russia hacked the election. Anyway, I think this has most of us concerned. And if you're in business, here's something that's interesting. Half of all small and medium-sized businesses have been victims of some type of cyber attack. My first guest today is Keith Moore, and he's here to shed some light on this security matter. Keith Moore is the CEO of CoverHound and Cyber Policy. Excuse me. And these organizations help consumers and businesses easily compare not only what's happening out there, but also compare insurance rates and cyber risks. Keith Moore, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you for having me, Bert. It's a pleasure to be on.
You bet. So let's talk about this. What are you seeing out there? What are some of the biggest threats for small businesses in case of a major cybersecurity data hack?
Well, we believe the biggest threat is ignorance. So a lot of small businesses think that because they don't operate with hundreds of thousands of customer records, that they're not going to be the target of a hacker or some type of cyber event. But that's definitely not true. And the best example of that is the Target breach. So if you think about Target and all the pain they've gone through financially and reputation-wise because of the cyber breach that they've had, it was literally caused by a contractor or a vendor. So you've got these large organizations that have the financial capabilities of securing their business and having all these best practices in place, but your best practices are only as good as the people that you work with and your customers. And that contractor or vendor that worked with Target is a great example of someone that needed cyber insurance and cybersecurity to protect their business, because they not only created a threat for their business, but also for a larger business that was a partner of theirs.
Right, right. Well, you know what? So you bring up kind of an interesting question for me, and that is, because Target does have a lot of balances and checks. They also have a fairly deep pocket. What do you say to, let's say, some small businesses out there? How can they protect themselves against the cyber threats when maybe they don't have the deep pockets that a Target has?
No, it's a great point. And the way we approach everything internally from a cybersecurity standpoint and how we work with our customers is we talk about first planning, second prevention, and then third the insurance piece. And some of those can be done for free. So we feel like a lot of the planning efforts and alleviating some of the ignorance around cybersecurity threats is can be done for free. It just takes a little time. And we realize that some small business owners, you know, time is just as valuable to them as their customers and their finances, but they do have to take some time to be more aware of what's out there. And the planning, like I said, can be free, and the planning can be as simple as just coming up with a basic password strategy or best practices for yourself or your employees, whether it's one employee or just a handful, and educating them on things like email best practices. Don't install a flash drive if you're not sure where the flash drive came from, and don't connect to Wi-Fi if you're not really sure who is the originating source of the Wi-Fi. Free Wi-Fi is everywhere, but it's also a source of how hackers can get into your computer. So just simple things. A lot of those can be done for free, and we take the approach that something when it relates to cybersecurity is definitely better than nothing.
Right, right. And, you know, what's interesting is you mentioned some very obvious things like the password. A lot of us, I have found many people who use very simplistic passwords, and they don't like the inconvenience of maybe changing that password every 3 months or every 6 months. One of the financial institutions that we work with, they automatically will deactivate your password every 3 months and make you come up with a new one. It's a pain in the butt, but it also ensures that you have a lower risk of getting hacked, your password being swiped. So you got to balance that out. And I like what you said there about, yes, time is sometimes as valuable as money, or as you mentioned, sometimes as valuable as your client's information. And therefore, I think that you have to invest the time to, you know, make some of these things happen. The best practices. I know that, let's say, a lot of websites today are hosted on the WordPress platform, and one of their best practices is to make sure that all your plugins are up to date and that your theme's up to date, because when these things are not up to date, then they become more hackable. And it's these little tiny things that we just take for granted that we don't want to do. We're always thinking as humans are that it's never going to happen to me, and that's when it happens.
Absolutely, your point was spot on. Having best practices around keeping things updated. I mean, that's the number one thing from the hackers and research that we've done. They like to look at outdated software, especially if it's a internet security monitoring software or even a camera. So they realize that a lot of these cameras that people have for 5 or 6 years, the operating system on those cameras or internet devices where they're doing monitoring for babies or security, the operating systems are never updated. So they know that they can simply look up the backdoor passwords on the internet for free. And hack into those devices and get access to the network.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's talk about this. Here you are. You are CEO of CoverHound and Cyber Policy. So I want to talk about specifically about cyber insurance. This seems like a fairly new area of coverage. I'm not that familiar with cyber insurance options for small businesses. So let's talk about this. What type of threats does it protect against?
So it protects you against ransomware. So if you're doing something on the internet and you end up with ransomware on your computer, that's definitely probably the most common and growing threat in the small business space today. A lot of people, you know, may get an email that looks like it's legitimately from a bank or for someone important. They click on it, and the next thing you know, they've installed ransomware. But there's also there's third-party liability for whenever the event of a data breach may happen. You know, you've got the liability to all your customers or potentially your business partners where their data has been exposed. But you also have just operational. So, like, if you have a hack and it brings your systems down and operationally you can't generate revenue for a day or two, you've got loss of revenue that could significantly impact a small business that is very mission critical to be up and running every business day. So it's simple things like that, but as you said, it's a relatively new offering. Cyber insurance as a concept has been around for over 20 years, but I would say over the last 2 years, it's become very specific to a lot of these events that are becoming more frequent.
Absolutely, and I want to talk about this real quick. You mentioned ransomware, and this is something a lot of people aren't, you know, most people are not familiar with unless it's happened to them, and you correct me if I'm wrong. Ransomware is just you download a virus, malicious software or something, maybe from an email, maybe by visiting some site, and this software, this malicious software is loaded onto your system, and it prevents you from accessing your computer until you pay to get rid of it.
It's amazing how it happens. It happens so frequently now to not only individuals but small businesses, and it's not even malicious type of acts that install the software. But once that happens, they can lock down your computer, and if everything you do as an organization is on that particular computer or a series of computers, you have to end up paying a fee or having an expert help you out of the situation.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the other thing is, this is something that is only going to become more prevalent. I think the newest thing that people need to be aware of is all these apps that we're loading on our phones. And what's so weird about some of these apps, I think all apps by default ask you to have access to your contacts and to your camera and all the stuff that in some cases seems kind of weird. You know, why does a calorie counter or a pedometer need access to your contacts and to your camera? And so you got to be careful, you know, just downloading apps nowadays.
Absolutely. It's the interconnectivity of everything, and it's Internet of Things that's all connected to your devices and the apps. And like you were mentioning before, the passwords, it only takes one bad password for that whole connectivity of everything, and everything you have ends up being exposed. And then they can take over your device, which sometimes you may not even know, or they could put ransomware on there, and then you know it, and it's an immediate dollar value that they're seeking from you.
Right. All right, so let's talk about this. Again, there's a lot being discussed about state-sponsored cyber threats. Is this something a small business really needs to worry about?
It is, as it pertains to their business and their industry. So a lot of small businesses may not deal with a lot of consumer records or data from their business partners. But if they do, they have to understand that hackers always have two core beliefs, and the first belief being they don't care about the source of data. All they care about is the value of that data. So if they have a credit card number or a health record or your Social Security number, all they care about is how much they can get on the black market for that information. So the other thing that they have as a core belief is they're going to find the easiest way to get that information without being traced. And typically that is going to be a small organization or a small business. But particularly the smaller they are, the smaller an organization, the less likely they are to pay for security software and security services or consulting. So they think
right.
that, hey, if this customer or this if this small business has access to valuable data, which I can sell in the black market, then I'm going to take the path of least resistance and the least likely to get caught and go after that data. So that's where you have to think like, okay, what data am I sitting on that's valuable, or what do I have access to that could be harmed to not only my customers but other business partners that we're working with?
Yeah. No, it's really a different type of mindset, because you've really, like you said, depending on the records that you are dealing with, credit cards, date of birth, driver's license, any type of, like you mentioned, Social Security type numbers, these become so valuable. And nowadays, you know, there's so much that can be done in such a short amount of time. I mean, if somebody has your birth date and your Social Security number, they basically own you at that point.
Yeah, I mean, they can go get a car in your name or potentially even a mortgage, and those could be situations where it's very costly to get out of that that type of identity breach, so to speak, or fraud.
Right.
And also it could impact your own purchase capabilities for years in advance.
Absolutely. So, okay, so let's talk about this real quick because we're out of time. So if somebody wants to find out more about your organization and what you guys do, where can they go?
I would love for them to just visit CyberPolicy. We're not actively trying to sell you everything under the sun, but we want to educate people first, especially small businesses, because we feel like in today's time with the looming cyber threats that are out there, small businesses are the most vulnerable. Because either A, they're not thinking about it, or they don't have the resources to attack it appropriately. So we take the simple approach, like I said before, of planning, help them plan for being a more cyber secure, and then giving them recommendations as a trusted advisor on what are the best prevention steps and what are some software or services that are available either for free on the web or for very affordable fees. And then the insurance, which we feel like is the most important piece. Because a lot of people don't think of insurance when, you know, you think about your house and something goes wrong with your house.
Right.
Usually the first person you call is an insurance company, and they really help you immediately remediate the situation and get an action plan in place. And they can think about cybersecurity the same way. These insurance experts that we work with, you know, they're immediately available to help you with not only legal feedback, but also forensics and technical expertise and operationally how to get back up and running so you can have your business generating revenue, you know, as it was the day before. So it's a lot of expertise of people that is dealing with this on a daily basis, whereas a small business, you may deal with this once in over your career, but that one situation could put you out of business.
Absolutely. Keith Moore, CyberPolicy.com. Thank you so much for stopping by.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. All righty. Good stuff there. Interesting, too, from Keith Moore. Interesting stuff. And it's something that a lot of us don't really think about. Your site being hacked. And I'm a big believer that it's not if it's going to happen, but when it's going to happen. Sooner or later, all websites get hacked. That is my opinion. I just know every day there's somebody getting hacked, and a lot of times it's just for, you know, it's for grins. It's just to be disruptive. I know here at Money for Lunch and at BurtMartinez.com, we have for the last couple of years paid for additional security measures on our websites, and continue to do so just because we've experienced that. And a lot of our clients have experienced that. And as Keith Moore was talking about, look, Target, and we know that Citibank, and I think even Amazon got hit. There's this rumor about the voter system getting the voting system or the voter system getting hacked. So Is it going to happen? Most likely. May not happen today, maybe 5 years from today or 10 years from today, but sooner or later, most likely something's going to happen. You might as well be prepared for it. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest is Anthony Saccaro. Anthony Saccaro, he's been on the show a couple of times. In fact, he was scheduled to be on the show last weekend. Speaking of systems going down, our system was down for several hours, so we couldn't actually conduct a real show last week. But it's good that he was able to make time and come back. Anthony Saccaro is a certified financial planner, founder and president of Providence Financial and Insurance Services. He's a financial planner and registered investment advisor, but is first and foremost an educator. For over 15 years, he has consulted with thousands of individuals about their finances. He's passionate about teaching and coaching clients on the universe of investment options in order to help them develop a clear income strategies for a secure future. Anthony Saccaro, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Bert, thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. So I think this is going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to be talking about, not only money, but about Trump. And bear with me 1 second. Had to hit the cough button there. So I want to dive into this and kind of get your thoughts on, Trump and the economy and obviously Trump's going to be very pro-business, and kind of get your thoughts on this real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Trump is in a very tough position. I think if he does what's right, it's not going to be good for the economy initially. And if he does what's wrong, meaning that he doesn't do what he says he's going to do, then I think it's not going to be good for the economy, both initially and long run. And, Bert, what I mean by that is if he does what he says he's going to do, eliminating a lot of these wasteful programs, there's going to be some jobs that are cut. There's going to be a lot of revenue that's initially lost by the government in tax breaks and so on, and that's not going to be good for the economy. It's one of those situations where it's one step back and two steps forward, and we have to take that step back. And that's the problem. If he does what he says, it's still going to be problematic in the short run. Long run, I think we'll be fine. Short run, problems, you got to be careful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what, and I think you're right. Look, as a citizen of the United States, we know that our government needs to make those hard decisions. We've known this for years, for decades. We have asked our government to make the tough decisions and cut some of these wasteful programs, some of these programs that are no longer really even required to be funded. Subsidizing corn is one of those programs that I personally feel that needs to be cut. But guarantee you, if that program was cut, some people may lose their jobs. It's going to hurt the corn industry for maybe a month. There's going to be a little dip in that industry, but I think it would rebound very quickly. And that's just one example. But there's a lot of examples there where if Trump does, as you said, if he does. As he says he's going to do, and I think that so far he's doing his best to keep his word. He's at this very high momentum right now. He's not wasting any time. He's not waiting to get into office. He's been meeting with people and making things happen at a very fast pace. So I'm confident that he's going to make some big changes. And as you said, yeah, it might affect us a little bit in the short run, but in the long term, I think it will be better for the economy and for us as a citizenry.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And yet I think it may affect us a little more than just negligible. You know, the stock market is right in the middle of the second largest bull market in history. And when you look at stock market history, and you know, the stock market's supposed to follow the economy, that really hasn't happened. But when you look at the history, there's always bears and bulls, and there's always major corrections and major crashes. And,
sure.
You know, the reality is you know, in the last decade and a half, we have had two crashes that have been close to 50%. The crash of 2001 was almost 50%. The crash of 2008 was over 50%. And yet when you put this last decade and a half in the history or context of the last 200 years of the stock market, this is very common. It's happened all the time. And a lot of these trends go 20 or 25 years, and they generally always have three major crashes. And a lot of times those crashes have got progressively worse. And I got to say, I think that, you know, somewhere along the line with something Trump says or a policy that Trump makes or something that goes on international that we can't see, maybe a black swan, something. But something is going to trigger that third major crash. And unfortunately, when that landslide starts, I don't think it's going to stop for a long time. And that's the problem that I have. You move one little pebble in the wrong place on a hillside, and you create an avalanche.
Sure. Well, you know what? And I'm going to go one step further and say I think it's unavoidable. Like you said, look, you know, it happens. It happens regardless of, you know, whatever. I mean, you could, you know, people could have said, and you can look at, hey, you know, the one that we had the last one that we had was triggered because of all this bad paper. But it's always something like that, right? It's always, you know, the paper was bad, or the stocks were overvalued, or there is this internet bubble or this other bubble. So there's always something that's going to trigger it. And it's just part of a marketplace, of a dynamic marketplace. We always, you know, we always say that you know, it's a supply and demand market, and because you have this real marketplace, it's going to have these, you know, these crashes. It's just a part of the process. And so I think whether it happens in 2017 or 2018, I think it's unavoidable. But you're right in the sense that maybe something that Trump does might make it happen a little bit sooner. But it's going to be interesting to see. And I personally have been hoarding my cash in hopes that I can maybe grab a little bit of this next crash.
Yeah, I really don't think you'll be sorry you did that. I mean, I would not say never the stock market. I would say not the stock market right now, generally speaking, because even if you just follow one stock market adage that's age old, which is buy low and sell high, right? And right now,
right,
we're at record highs. And so I agree with everything. I think if you hold cash, even if you earn nothing for a couple of years, that's better than losing whatever you're going to lose the next time the market does crash. And that's just, you know, I think that's important to understand. I think you're being very smart with that.
Right. Now, okay, so I want to ask you this. I want to get your thoughts on this. So let's talk about interest rates. What do you see, for interest rates for 2017?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think where the rubber meets the road has to do, or is proven by, interest rates. You know, the government wants you to believe everything's okay, but I think where the proof is whether interest rates are okay. You know, when the market crashed in 2001, interest rates came from 6% down to zero. And when the market recovered from 2002 to 2007, rates went back up to 6%. And then in 2008, when the market crashed, rates came back down to zero, and that didn't work. So then the government started printing money. They started doing this quantitative easing, and now we've recovered, but interest rates have not recovered. They're still down at zero, and that tends to show us that the economy is not doing well, and I think we've got a long time to go with low interest rates. They can't raise the interest rate because the economy is not doing as well as they want you to believe. I mean, think about this. If the economy is doing as good as everyone wants you to believe, still needing help from the government to get food. And furthermore, you know, there's other subsidies too. There's housing subsidies. There's utility bill subsidies. There's, you know, telephones. There's lots of subsidies. And if you look at all the government subsidies that are around, one out of three people, 110 million people, are getting some kind of help from the government somewhere. Why is one out of three people needing help from the government in an economy that is, quote unquote, thriving with the stock market as high as it's been? It makes no sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? And I think that one of the other things that we need to take into consideration, and this is not going to happen all at once, but I think it's happening bit by bit. And this goes back to what you were saying, you know, about some of the changes coming up, is that, look, we are moving faster and faster towards a, what do you call it, what's the word I'm looking for, almost a robot state. For example, we have Uber, who is now placing a bunch of driverless cars in Phoenix. They're testing out driverless cars in Phoenix. The taxi cab industry is testing out driverless cars in New York. You know, and so that is going to displace, eventually it's going to displace drivers. And so we have, you know, all these, what do you call it, cognitive computers, this artificial intelligence, this wave of artificial intelligence that is going to shift our economy. And in order for that shift to happen, it's going to displace people for, you know, for a while. And we saw this happen in Detroit. I remember when all the robots came into Detroit and started replacing all those auto workers, the economy felt that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's certainly going to happen again. You're, you know, in the financial services world, they're talking about robo-advisors, which is, you know, essentially an electronic computer system that tells someone how to invest. And in some ways, you know, when you look at finances and you look at investments and you look at, you know, that aspect of things, I mean, that's all numbers. And what are computers good at? You know, computers are good at numbers. But, you know, and that's not just, like you said, it's not just the financial industry. It's with taxis, it's cars, it's with Uber, it's with everything. And you know, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, if there's a lot of displaced workers, you know, is that going to be good for the economy or is that going to be bad for the economy? And obviously that, you know, that the answer is obvious. Now, Trump, you know, is coming in and wanting to cut taxes. And I think that, I mean, ultimately that's going to be good for the economy. But I've gotten a lot of questions from people, Bert, that say, hey, how can he cut taxes? We're in debt. How can he cut taxes? And how is tax cutting good for the economy? I mean, if we got to raise revenue as a government, don't we have to raise taxes? And that's a Democratic belief. But the reality is when he cuts taxes, it allows employers to be able to save some money in taxes, which means that they can go in and buy improvements or buy capital equipment or buy what they need or hire more people. And that's what a lot of employers are going to do, is they're going to hire more people. And as they hire more people, they've got more people, more revenue coming in from the government, so that these people now can, there's more taxes being paid, actually, and then these people are going to go spend money. And if they spend money, then corporate revenues are going to go up. And if corporate revenues go up, then they're going to hire more people. So it's a very nice circle to be in, and it all starts with cutting taxes. But believe it or not, Bert, a lot of people don't understand what I just said. And I'm hoping that what he does helps to counteract some of the artificial intelligence moves that are going on. So you've got jobs that are being displaced, but other companies that are now needing to hire people. Why? Because taxes are being cut, and I'm hoping that there's just a shift from one to another, so these people aren't really out of work for long.
Right, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, you know, because that is, again, it's just something that is needed. Look, to incentivize business, then the entire economy grows. More people
That's
are
right.
going to be put to work. And we're seeing it right now. Look, Trump is doing his best, and I'm hoping that he does this throughout his administration, and it's just not a publicity stunt. But look what he did with Carrier, and now Ford has saying that they're going to hire more people and what do you call it? Invest more in their plants here in the U.S. versus in Mexico. All that is good. And so, you know, if all Trump does, if all Trump does is get more people to work, he's going to fix 90% of our problems.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the whole critical issue there, is get more people to work, and not just more. I mean, unemployment rate's down, but, you know, people are still making on average less than they were making 20 years ago. So, you know, there's the other side of the coin. But here's the thing I think, you know, people may not understand too, and that is that when you're in a group or an industry or a clique, if you will, you know, maybe you're a doctor, let's say, doctors respect doctors. Engineers respect engineers. Attorneys respect attorneys. And when you, if you're a non-attorney or a non-doctor and you sit down with a doctor or attorney, yeah, you might be friends, but that camaraderie isn't there.
Right.
The one thing that this country has been missing is, you know, Trump is a businessman, and, you know, Obama was not a businessman. And so when you're talking about increasing business, getting business to thrive, Trump has the experience that business people are going to respect Trump in a way that they just can't respect anyone that's not a business person. And that's huge. And we've already seen it. You know, if Obama, and I'm not saying anything bad necessarily, but if he sits down with, you know, Rex Tillerson, right? Well, Rex is not going to pay attention to him. Trump sits down with him. Guess what? They're having business conversation. They're on the same page.
Right. Right. And I agree with that. Look, whether or not you liked President Obama, whatever, I believe that, you know, these men going into office and these women as well are doing the best they can. You know, they're human. So they're just doing the best they can. But I think that there's an added, at least for me personally, I feel a little bit more secure, a little bit more confident when my president understands business, when my president understands the economy, when my president has a focus at on business. Because look, ultimately, small business is the backbone of this economy. And if we get more people opening up small businesses, if they can access capital, if they can grow their business, that's going to ultimately put more people to work. And then it creates the velocity of money. And then it, you know, it gives people more, you know, more jobs. And it's this continuous circular thing that when business feels when business doesn't feel confident in their government, when business is being attacked, then everything starts to shrink.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It all starts with business. And, you know, I love the fact that Trump's got the business background. I love the fact that he's got the business acumen. You know, there are some people that are complaining that he's hiring all business people, cabinet. I'm like, what do you want? You want a bunch of broke people that don't have any experience? They're politicians. I love what he's doing there. And here's the thing behind the scenes. I really believe, and I hope I'm right, and I mean, I think the entire country is right now kind of taking a step back and saying, okay, he's president, in a couple of days he's going to be in office, I hope we made the right decision. I kind of think that that's what everyone kind of is collectively feeling at this moment. But
yes,
the fact is, you know, the fact is that I really believe in my heart of hearts that he has this country's best interest in heart. He's always been somewhat involved in politics, and I think he's gotten so much. He's billionaire. He doesn't need to ever make anything in his life. He's got his. I think he really, really cares about the country and really believes a certain philosophy about how to get the country back on track. And I think that's his number one goal. I really don't think he has any selfish motivations to help him or his friends, you know, with tax breaks and so on. I think he really, really cares and really wants to help the country.
I agree. And you know, one of the things that that makes me further believe that is that the media, the world, is going to be watching what he does. They're going to be seeing, they're watching for him to give something to one of his business buddies that he should not be giving, right? They're looking for that. So I think you're right. You know, this is the first president that we have in the office that got there by spending his own money, a lot of his own money. I know that he did raise funds, but he didn't do it from the very beginning. It was something that he did later in his campaign. And also, I don't think he spent as much money as the other people normally do. I think that he spent a lot less. And when I say a lot less, I think like about a third of what Hillary spent. Some people also, Anthony, have tried to smear him, saying, look, this guy is bankrupt, multiple company. He's failed multiple times. You know, that's just part of doing business. Look, if you play baseball, you're going to strike out more times than not. But like a Hall of Fame home run hitter is only getting on base 30% of the time. That means he's failing 70% of the time, and he's considered a stud.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But here's the key. He worked within the guidelines of the law. The law said you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, you can't do this and this and this. He used the guidelines of the law to his benefit. I mean, that just – why is everyone complaining about that? The law says you can do it. He did it. His favorite line for me was the favorite line out of the entire campaign trail was when Hillary said something to him in a debate like, you don't pay taxes or you haven't paid taxes for 7 years or something, whatever that was. And he said, well, that makes me smart. And I agree with that. Anytime you can use the law and legally reduce your taxes or eliminate taxes, that does make you smart. So it's the law that's the problem. It's not his use of it that's the problem.
Absolutely. Look. If we had the kind of money that Donald Trump had, you know, I guarantee you, when you and I sit down, you and I are going to be talking about how do we avoid paying taxes. Hey, Anthony, what are you doing to reduce your tax? Oh, Bert, this is what I'm doing. What are you doing? Oh, this is what I'm doing, because that's smart. I mean, here's what people don't understand. Part of any wealth strategy is tax reduction. You cannot build
no question.
A massive amount of wealth without planning your taxes.
Question. You're absolutely right. And I'll go one step further. I mean, it's not even just sitting down with someone who, you know, is a billionaire talking about taxes. You know, I've got employees and I've got single people that are getting killed in taxes, making $60,000-$75,000 a year and spending, you know, a third of it in taxes. These people are planning on their taxes too. They're sitting down and they're saying, what do I do? Are there any unused deductions? Should I buy a home for taxes? They're doing tax planning too. So if you're not doing tax planning, you're just missing the boat. You don't have to be in that Trump's category to be felt or feel the effects of taxes. You know, we, as a small business owner, you know, the amount of taxes that I pay every pay period is almost the same amount that my employees net in total. It's absurd, and if I could reduce those taxes, I'd hire another person in a heartbeat, maybe two.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, you know, and let's talk about this. I know that we're having a we've been talking about a lot of different things, but back to money and investments and savings and retirement. Let's never forget that it all starts with us. You know, there are people today that are making $200,000-$300,000 a year, $2 or $3 million a year, and they're broke. And there are people who are making $30,000-$50,000 a year, and they're socking money away month after month, and they have and they are set to retire. So it's a mindset, it's a habit, and not, you know, and not necessarily how much money you make.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have a client who has worked at the same restaurant in some capacity as an employee. He's been a waiter. I don't know exactly, but I think of him. He's been at the same restaurant for 30 or 40 years, never making a huge amount of money. It's like $1.5 million just socked away, debt-free. And I'm proud of someone like that, but it is a matter of paying yourself first, living below your means, making sure that your income exceeds your expenses at all times, not putting something on the credit card that you want, and just being responsible and saving first, you know, from your net income. And if you do that, and if you do it long enough, then, you know, you'll be set for retirement. You'll be in good shape. But, yeah, it's the mindset today. It's not that. the mindset today is I want it now, and if I got to go in debt to get it, I'm going to get it. And, you know, the cruise is on sale, and it's half price. It's normally $5,000. It's only $3,000 now. Let's take the cruise, and, oh, by the way, let's put it on a credit card because it's a good deal. That's the mindset today, and it's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, unfortunately, the mindset, and I think that, that, again, has nothing to do with, really, with your how much money you make. I love the example you gave with your client who's been working at the same restaurant. You know, there are people, and I think you and I have talked about this before, but there are people out there who don't like to save money every week because they don't have a whole lot of money to save. You know, and I'm a big believer, whether you're saving $5 a week or $500 a week, it's the habit that you build, not so much the money that you're saving, because sooner or later you will make more money. And also, I want to emphasize what you talked about, living below your means. This is a very simple financial strategy that doesn't require education. It doesn't require technology. It doesn't require status. To live below your means, or better yet, well below your means. So if you can afford a $300,000 or $500,000 home, but if you live on something that maybe that is way below that, that's, again, that's a financial strategy, and it's an easy one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And too many people have the mindset that, you know, I make $3,000 a month, so, you know, I got a budget for $3,000 a month, and they're living check to check. And really, it is just a matter of not budgeting for $3,000 a month. Budget for $2,000 a month, or budget for $2,500
right.
a month, so you have a buffer. If you have a buffer, you can save. If you don't have a buffer, you can't save. And that's the issue.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know what? And again, you know, these are some things that doesn't require a certification of any kind. I mean, if you want to have a lot of peace and tranquility in your life, you know, live below your means, sock that money away, and then at the right time you get together with a professional and you start investing wisely, man, that's ultimately a great gift to yourself, because you have that peace of mind knowing that whether the market is up or down, whether you have a job or not, you have a buffer and you can take care of yourself and your family.
Yeah, you are absolutely 100% correct. And I have this conversation with young people, you know, virtually every day or every week at least, and they don't necessarily understand that. When I tell some of these people, you know, what we've just been talking about, buffer and saving and paying yourself first, a lot of time they look at me like deer in headlights, and this is news to them. They never thought about that before. And Generation X, I think, is really bad at this. But fortunately, X and Y, I think, but fortunately, the millennials that are coming on seem to be a little more astute, and they're a bigger generation than the baby boomers. And so I think that's good for the baby boomers as far as Social Security and retirement is concerned. But they're going to have to get jobs as well. But the fact is that I think there are, all the polls and everything that I've read about them say that they're a little sharper, and they tend to be a little more in tune than maybe Xers and Yers. And so I'm hoping that's the case, and we have a generation of young people that actually understands what you and I have just spoken about.
Absolutely, because when you look at the Great Generation, and they were called the Great Generation, and I know a lot of people are going, man, you guys are reaching way back. But here's the lesson. When these guys were young people, they were in the Depression. When I say young people, they were probably 12, maybe 15, something like that. And then when they were in their, early teens, early 20s, I'm sorry, late teens, early 20s, they were in World War II. This generation, because of the amount of adversity that affected them at an early age, understood the power of money. They respected it. They saved it. And because of their ability to save, a lot of great things happen. And I think a lot of people forget that they did a lot because they were savers. And they invested in the stock market. They invested in real estate. They invested their money. But it started with them saving it and, you know, living below their means, like you mentioned. And then we've gotten away from that. And we've had multiple problems, and bankruptcies have blossomed and all this other stuff because we've gotten away from these very basic tenets of financial wealth, these financial security tenets, right? That you got to start by saving. And it's and like I said, my opinion is it doesn't matter how much you're saving. Get into the habit of saving, and then from there you feel better and more confident about saving, and then you're able to, then you have money to, you know, to invest.
Yeah, you're 100% right on. You hit the nail on the head, and it really is a generational thing. You know, it seems like if you talk to someone that, you know, was 15 and 20 in World War II, someone whose parents lived through the Great Depression in 29, you know, that person does have a respect for money because they've lived through it. They've seen it. The collective right. wisdom of that age, the Depression era, was, hey, don't gamble. Don't touch the stock market. Stay away from that. Protect your principal. Do everything you can to protect your principal. Live off of the interest and dividends. Don't touch that principal. And, you know, and then you fast forward to the 80s and 90s when the market was just so prevalent, and this generation thinks, like, no matter what, the answer is the stock market because they've seen the market go up. They've seen the market grow. They grew up in that paradigm, the 80s and 90s, and so you've got a bunch of younger financial advisors that think the stock market is the answer to all your problems. Well, the reality is that the millennials are really somewhere in the middle. The millennials right now are, you know, ages 15 to 35, that generation that's there. And you know, we've been in a market now where for the last 17 years we've had two crashes and recoveries, but no growth. And the millennials have grown up with these crashes and recoveries, and their mindset is, hey, why do I want to be in the market in the first place? And I think it's right. not a bad mindset. I think it's a defensive mindset, and they're a big generation. So I'm hoping that the millennials can really turn around some of the collective current thoughts of the country today and really bring it all back to reason. Because having all your money in the, you know, Wall Street casino today makes no sense, but a lot of people think that's the right thing to do.
Sure, sure. Okay, so let's talk about this real quick. I want to get your final thoughts. If you and I were sitting down, you know, and again, this is just hypothetical, you know, there's no guarantee. There's, you know, I want to make sure that this is an absolute disclosure here that, you know, we're just talking hypothetical. This is just for informational purposes only. You know, what would you tell somebody as far as what would you do right now? Here it is, January 18, 2017. What would you tell me that I should do with my money?
Yeah, great question, and it's not so hypothetical. I answer that question every single day. So, you know, the fact is that if you need your money within the next 2 years, I'm going to suggest you just set it aside, put it on the sidelines, don't gamble with it, don't invest, don't do anything. If the market's too volatile, things are too up in the air right now. We don't know which way it's going to go. And my two-year rule is that if you need it or you think you're going to need it in the next 2 years, I'd rather have you sit it in the bank, protect it, and earn nothing than gamble with it. Now, on the other hand, if you have money and you're saving for retirement, and this is money you're not going to need for a long time, then at this stage of life, depending on where you are, if you're younger, though, you know, then what I'm going to recommend is that you invest for income and not growth. You know, when you invest for growth, you buy stocks, and of course you can make a lot of money doing that, but you can lose a lot of money. And I think that right now losing a lot of money is still more probable than making a lot of money at this point. But when you invest for income, Bert, what you're doing is you're investing in investments that are going to give you some type of consistent dividends or interest. And there's a whole universe of options out there that are designed to work like this. And I'm talking somewhere in the range of 4 to 7%, somewhere in that range. And if you're younger and you invest for income, at least you're getting 4, 5, 6, 7% a year, treading water until a better time to get back in the stock market. But that's what I'm having our clients doing: tread water for now, invest in safer investments designed to give you, you know, 4 to 7%, and just avoid the risk at this point. And the reality is, those investments are not going to make you rich, but they're going to make sure you don't go broke. And if you can tread water for the next couple of years, and if you're earning 5% on average, you're doing great. And then when it is a better time to get in the stock market, then I think that, you know, that we have a lot of clients that are earning 4 or 5% waiting for a better time.
Right. And I like your strategy there because, look, it's much better to sit it out and not risk your money versus gamble your money and all of a sudden you lost 10 or 15 or 20%. Recovering that back could take a long time. So you sit it out, you wait to see what happens, because I agree with everything you said. Right now, it's kind of a weird, funky time, and we don't know what's happening, and we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, look, in the next 100 days, as Trump takes office, massive things could change. I mean, this guy is going after the EPA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education. We don't know what's going to happen when he starts making these massive cuts.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. And that's why we have a lot of our clients just in investments that are earning some kind of consistent rate of return, something that's safe. And there's a whole universe of options out there that are designed to work like this. You want to talk with your advisor to figure out which ones make sense for you, because they all have their own risks. But none of them really have the risk of the stock market. And if you're a little older, if you're retired out there and you're listening to this show, then I'm also going to suggest that, you know, there is no rule and there is no law that says you have to have money in the stock market. I ask this question all the time, and I don't remember the last time I got a negative answer, but oftentimes I'll ask a retiree, you know, if you could live your entire retirement on a 4% or 5% rate of return, accomplish all your retirement dreams, and be able to adjust for inflation and never have to worry about losing money in the stock market again, would you do it? And
yes,
almost all the time they say yes, absolutely. Then the question is, well, then why are you in the stock market? You don't have to be in the stock market, but, you know, Wall Street doesn't want you to think that because that's what they sell.
Sure. Well, and I think it goes back to awareness too. I mean, look, going out there and becoming aware of the different options and the risks associated with those options takes time and energy. And
yeah,
and
no,
sometimes
you're...
people don't, you know, they don't know where or how to dedicate themselves to that kind of time and energy. And so, you know, what's the old saying? The devil that you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I agree with you 100%. And yet, if we go one step further, most financial advisors out there work for a big firm and they get paid commission from the investments they recommend. And all these big firms, these Wall Street firms, they sell stocks and mutual funds. So, you know, a consumer walks into one of these big firms with a fistful of cash thinking they're getting non-biased advice about all the investments that are out there. And that's not true. You know, one of the reasons I went independent is because I want to be able to offer everything that exists to my clients, regardless of whether I work for a firm or not. And the fact is that as an independent firm, I can offer so many investments that I could not offer when I worked for a firm. So you have to be with someone that's independent as well, too, that has access to all the investments and not just certain investments. Otherwise, the information you get is going to be skewed or biased towards the investments they sell.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anthony Saccaro, we're out of time. It's always good to have you on the show, my friend. Let's get together again in about 2 or 3 months, and let's get a report card on how Trump's doing. Looking forward to having you back.
I would love to do it. Thank you for having me, Bert, and I love Money for Lunch. Thank you so much.
You bet. Good stuff there from financial advisor Anthony Saccaro. I love his energy, and I like his take on the market. It's a perfect time to just take a breather, take your money out, and maybe find out where you can earn 4, 5, even 10% on your money without risking your principal. Wow, what a thing. Anyways, always, we're glad to have you on the show, and as always, we appreciate you very much. And as always, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.